A Memoir of the Reverend Edward Payson. Chapter 1. Birth of Edward Payson. His Early Years. Intellectual Qualities. Filial and Fraternal Conduct. Moral Character. His Literary Education. Enters Harvard College. His Reputation There. Edward Payson was born at Rhynes, New Hampshire, July 25, 1783. His father was the Reverend Seth Payson, D.D., pastor of the church in Rhynes, a man of piety and public spirit, distinguished as a clergyman and favorably known as an author. His mother, Greta Payson, was a distant relative of her husband. Their lineage, after being traced back a few generations, meeting in the same stock, to the Christian fidelity of these parents, there is the fullest testimony in the subsequent and repeated acknowledgments of their son, who habitually attributed his religious hopes, as well as his usefulness and life, under God, to their instructions, example, and prayers, especially to those of his mother. She appears to have admitted him to the most intimate, unreserved, and confiding intercourse, which was yet so wisely conducted as to strengthen rather than diminish his filial reverency, to have cherished a remarkable inquisitiveness of mind, which early discovered itself in him, and to have patiently heard and replied to the almost endless inquiries about his early thirst for knowledge led him to propose. His father was not less really and sincerely interested for the welfare of his son, but from the nature of the relation and the cause of official duty, his opportunities must have been less frequent, and his instructions have partaken of a more set and formal character. With the mother, however, opportunities were always occurring, and she seems to have been blessed with a faculty and disposition to turn them to the best advantage. Edward's recollections of her extended back to very early childhood, and he has been heard to say that though she was very solicitous that he might be liberally educated and might receive every accomplishment which would increase his respectability and influence in the world, yet he could distinctly see that the supreme, the all-absorbing concern of her soul regarding him was that he might become a child of God. This manifested itself in her discipline, her counsels, her expostulations, and her prayers, which were followed up with a perseverance that nothing could check. And they were not in vain. From the first development of his mental powers, his mind was more or less affected by his condition and the prospects as a sinner. It is amongst the accredited traditions of his family that he was often known to weep under the preaching of the gospel when only 3 years old. About this period, too, he would frequently call his mother to his bedside to converse on religion and to answer numerous questions respecting his relations to God in the future world. How long this seriousness continued, or to what interruptions it was subjected, does not clearly appear, nor is much known as to the peculiar character of his exercises at that time. But that they were not mere transient impressions seems highly probable from the fact that in subsequent years his mother was inclined to the belief that he was converted in childhood. There was some other cause than maternal partiality for this opinion, as she did not cherish it alone. Besides, his intimate friends have reason for believing that he never neglected secret prayer while a resident in his father's family. The evidences of his piety, however, were at this period far from being conclusive. He, at least, does not appear to have regarded them as such. Neither were they so regarded by his father, who on this account hesitated to send him to college for months, if not years, after his academical preparation was completed. How far those mental qualities which distinguished him in maturity were apparent in his early days cannot now be known, for though he died comparatively young, his parents had gone before him, and their surviving children were all younger than this son. Strictly speaking, therefore, no companion of his childhood survives. The very few instances belonging to this period of his history which have escaped oblivion, though not adequate to satisfy curiosity, are, on the whole, characteristic. When about 6 years of age, he rode one horse and led another at the same time for a distance of 20 miles. No trifling adventure for a child, and no doubtful indication that his well-known energy and perseverance had already dawned. That he was a minute observer of nature and highly susceptible of emotions from the grand and beautiful in the works of God must be obvious to all who have listened to his conversation or his preaching. His taste for the sublime very early discovered itself. During a tempest, he might be seen exposed on the top of a fence or of some other eminency while the lightnings played and the thunders rolled around him, sitting in delightful composure and enjoying the solemnity of the scene. He is said to have manifested an early predilection for arithmetic and was a tolerable proficient in the art of reading at the age of 4 years, an art which no man ever employed to better advantage. The surprising quickness with which he would transfer to his own mind the contents of a book at a time when a new book was a greater rarity than it now is, threatened to exhaust his sources for information through this medium. All the books in his father's collection and in the parish library, which were of a character suited to his age and attainments, were read before he left the paternal home, and retained with such tenacity of memory as to be ever available after for illustrating truth or enlivening, embellishing discourse. It is natural to inquire whether there was anything in the circumstances of his early youth which will account for his mental habits and especially for the rapidity of his intellectual operations. A partial answer may be found in the fact that his time was divided between labor and study. His father, like most ministers of country parishes, derived the means of supporting his family in part from a farm which his sons assisted in cultivating. From his share in these agricultural labors, the subject of his memoir was not exempted, particularly in the busy seasons of the year. But whatever was his employment, though he appears to have engaged in it with cheerfulness and to have prosecuted it with fidelity, his thirst for knowledge was the ruling passion of his life. This he sought to quench or rather to cherish by resorting to his book at every interval from toil, however short, when he tasked his mind to the utmost of his power, intent on making the greatest possible acquisition in a given time. His mind, though strung up to the highest pitch of exertion at these seasons, suffered no injury thereby, as it was so soon diverted from its employment by a call to the field, and every repetition of the process extended its capacity and power. The acquisition in this way obtained furnished materials on which to employ the thoughts while engaged in manual labors, which he would not fail to digest and lay up in store for future use. A voluntary discipline of most auspicious influence as it respects the faculty of acquiring knowledge and the power of retaining it. His early literary as well as moral and religious education is believed to have been conducted principally by his parents, except the studies preparatory to college, which were pursued in part at least at the academy in New Ipswich, I-P-S-W-I-C-H. After his preparatory course was completed, his father delayed sending him to college, assigning as the reason that he saw in him no certain indications of special seriousness, and could not therefore consistently educate him, that it were better on all accounts to retain him on the farm, for, added he, to give you a liberal education while destitute of religious principles would be like putting a sword into the hands of a madman. Whether the father was led to adopt such strong language after having observed in his son the existence of those properties which in their future development were to give him such power over his species, or whether it was only the application of what he held as a general principle, there does not appear to have been, either in the disposition or conduct of the son, any particular cause for his apprehensions. His fidel affections and conduct have been and ever continue to be most exemplary, as manifested in his letters when absent, and by his cheerful obedience when at home. His paternal feelings were kind, and his conduct towards his brothers and sisters faithful and affectionate. By them he was greatly beloved in his vacations, when he should visit home and mingle again in the domestic circle, were anticipated with delightful interest as the halcyon days of their lives. His moral conduct comes down to us even from the first without a blemish, and by the consent of all he sustained the reputation of a magnanimous, honorable, and generous youth. His father's decision, however, was not peremptory and unalterable. Young Payson was indeed detained from college, yet permitted to pursue his studies, but whether exclusively or in connection with other employments does not appear, till he was fitted to join the sophomore class, when, all objections being waived, he entered Harvard College in an advanced standing at the commencement in 1800, about which time he completed his 17th year. He had now a new ordeal to pass, a severe test for both his talents and character. Many a youth, having been regarded as a prodigy of genius in his native parish or in a country village, and who had anticipated the same eminency at the seat of science, had found himself sadly disappointed in being there, obliged to take his place below the middle rank. Thus it had nearly fared with Payson. Not that he was destitute of real talent, but there were circumstances which prevented that talent from being appreciated. The first impressions respecting him were favorable. You would have taken him, says a classmate, for an unpolished, ignorant country lad, exceedingly modest and unassuming and reserved in his manners. And as we generally look for a long time at the words and actions of a character through the same medium by which it was first presented to us, his merit was for a long time unknown. This habit of judging from appearances is, perhaps, unavoidable, though often very injurious. In the greenness of his youth, Mr. Payson's modesty might easily be mistaken for bashfulness, as though life he had much of a downcast look, holding his eyes inclined to the earth, except when warmly engaged in conversation. Then, indeed, they would beam most expressively, and when addressing an audience from the pulpit, he would pry through the portals of the head and give a thrilling emphasis to the language of his lips. Mr. Payson's classmates, thus quoted, and who also occupied the same room with him during the whole period of his residency at college, bears decided testimony to the purity of his morals and the regularity of his habits, as well as to his other estimable qualities. With his intimate friends, he was social, communicative, and particularly interesting and improving, and by those who best knew him was much beloved. He was distinguished for his industry. His first care always was to get his lesson, which engaged him but a short time, and then he would resume his reading. He was invariably prepared to meet his instructor, prompt in reciting, and seldom committed a mistake. His manner of rehearsing was rapid, his tone of voice low, with a kind of instinctive shrinking from everything which had the appearance of display. He seems to have been regarded as no more than a decent scholar by his associates and teachers generally, but after having been with him a few months, I was convinced that he possessed uncommon mental powers. Others knew not this, because they knew not the man. During the latter part of his collegiate course, as he became more known, he rose rapidly in the estimation of both the governors and his classmates as a young man of correct morals, admirable disposition, and respectable talents. The testimony of another classmate agrees with this as to the general character of the man, but is more discriminating and positive in reference to his merits as a scholar. The circumstance of his joining the class at an advanced standing, combined with his naturally retiring and unobtrusive manners, contributed, probably, to his being so little known to a large portion of his college contemporaries, who seemed scarcely aware that his talents were of that high order, by which he was soon afterwards so eminently distinguished. Yet, even at that early period, he manifested an energy, hardihood, and perseverance of character which were sure indications of success into whatever course he might evidently direct his professional pursuits. In the regular course of college studies, pursued at the time of his residency at Cambridge, he maintained the reputation of a respectable scholar in every branch. Intellectual and moral philosophy were more to his taste than the physical science. Yet he sustained a distinguished rank in the higher branches of the mathematics, as well as in natural philosophy and astronomy, at that time so unpopular and so little understood by a large portion of the students. It is not remembered, however, that there was any public recognition of the distinguished merits in him at the time he commenced Bachelor of Arts. The reputation of being a great reader, as the phrase is often applied, is a very undesirable distinction. It is one, however, which Mr. Payson bore in common with thousands who are not the wiser for their reading. His frequent resort to the college library was a theme of raillery to with his fellow students, who at one time represented him as having a machine to turn over the leaves, and at another as having left off taking out books because he had read all the thousands in the alleys of old Harvard. Ridiculous, in his case, was egregiously misapplied. For, says his constant companion in the study and in the dormitory, everything he read he made his own. He had the strongest and most tenuous memory I've ever known. It is truly astonishing with what rapidity he could read, how soon he could devour a large volume, and yet give the most particular and accurate account of its contents. Testimonies of the same kind might be multiplied and confirmed by many anecdotes, which to a stranger would appear incredible, illustrating the power of his faculty and the severity of those tests to which it has been subject. End of chapter 1, having been read by Peter John Parises, also known as Brian Dean. None of my audios are copyrighted. Please feel free to make as many copies as you desire to the glory of God.